What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the Art of Suffering podcast with Dalton Darnell. Today, we have Jason Cook. He was recommended to me by some of my Facebook friends when I made a post asking for podcast guests. And if I'm not mistaken, you just got back from the biggest horse show of the year, correct?
Yeah, for us, we go to Tulsa every year in July to the ABRA. It's the Buckskin Horse Association World Show.
Yep. Okay, cool. How'd we end up there? Did you do well? Did you enjoy it, or how'd it go?
Yeah, it was very hot, and we ended up doing okay. We ended up taking some of our amateurs and non-pros down there, and I think we ended up winning 9 either world championships or reserve world championships between my wife and I, or our amateurs and non-pros that we took.
Okay, cool. So when you're talking about amateurs and non-pros, these are people you train?
Yeah, they're basically people that go out and buy a horse, and they come to us, or they buy a horse from us, or we give them lessons, and some of them keep a horse with us, and then we take them to shows and coach them. We're basically the coach. And sometimes we show the horse also, and sometimes just they show the horse.
Okay. Do you like coaching? Do you like doing that side of it?
Absolutely. That's really my gift and why I was put here probably on this earth more than anything. And that's to teach. I'm more of a teacher than a competitor. I do like the competition. My wife likes it way more than I do, but I really like teaching and articulating things to people.
That's cool, man. That's another level of manhood that you get to that you don't really know is coming when you kind of go from a competitor to a coach. That's kind of happened to me in several realms of my life over the last, 10 years or so, where it's like I'm less of the guy in the ring, so to speak, and more of the helping hand to the person who could actually win. You know what I mean?
Yes. And it helps you understand and become better as a horseman and as a teacher. Because I heard a saying one time, if you want to know if you understand something, you really don't understand it till you can teach it to a 6-year-old. If you can teach it to a 6-year-old, you understand it a lot better. And I know when you guys came and done a clinic down at the barn, you guys get people coming in there very green, very green. I mean, they don't even know how to coil a rope. And a lot of people can rope well and do things well, but it's very difficult from my perspective in the horsemanship world. It's very difficult for a lot of horsemen to articulate it in a way that people can digest it.
100%. I would say horsemanship is one of the hardest things on earth to teach somebody because it's feel. It's not really roping is mechanical. It's pretty easy to teach the mechanics of roping to somebody because they're the same almost all the time. Whereas horsemanship is like this. It's a relationship. You're teaching someone how to have a relationship. You know what I mean? It's kind of abstract is a good word.
It absolutely is. And that's what makes it so unique because most human beings, for the most part, what I have dealt with are more geared towards they want to buy a program and put the formula in and then bang, they get the product. And that's where with horses, there's a lot of frustration because it's not A plus B equals C. It just doesn't work like that.
No. That's why I've always had trouble. I would say have trouble. I'm an okay horseman. I get along with most every horse that I ride, and I understand the principles to a certain degree, but my mind is far more mechanical, and I have a harder time controlling my emotions when it comes to a horse, because it's frustrating. It's like, do your freaking job, buddy, And I think that's why me and Dad were always really good with those clinics together, because I'm more mechanical than he is when it comes to teaching the roping. Like I can break it down into very small bite-sized pieces of what you need to be doing. And he is an absolute animal of a horseman. He speaks their language. I'll never be what he is when it comes to the horse. I'm not disciplined enough, honestly. And that's what I found, and that's what I've kind of watched over the years, all the different people I've cowboyed with or worked with or taught. The guys who are really, really handy with a horse are very disciplined humans. Like, they're going to set the standard for the horse and require it every time, and they don't ever get up and they don't ever get down. They're just right there where they need it to be, and it's pretty fun to watch. It's like magic when you watch a guy who's really handy with it.
It really is. It's an art, and there's so much timing and feel, and there's so much going on that you don't even see. And and I think you need an eye on you a lot of times to help develop your feel. You need to feel a lot of different horses, number one, and a lot of different scenarios. And then you have to have someone there telling you, saying, right there, right there.
Mm-hmm. And maybe, that's the ultimate horse trainer word. There. There. That's the word. Freaking right there. There. Yeah. Dude, if my dad has said there to me one time, he said it 5 billion times, dude. He is like, oh, it's so funny, man. But that's cool, man. So where are you originally from, Jason? Are you originally from Missouri? Did you grow up there? Where are you from?
I am. Yes. Mm-hmm. I was raised not far from right here where I'm at right now, in a town called Powell, Missouri. Powell, Missouri has really nothing but a post office. And the only thing you might know Powell for is Albert E. Brumley, the famous gospel songwriter, wrote I'll Fly Away. And he wrote that song right down there at Powell, Missouri. It's just a hole in the wall. And I lived there for 17 years. And then actually about 19 years. And then I ended up moving to Arizona. That's where my cowboy adventure started. I've always dreamed of being a cowboy, moving out west, working on a ranch, but I really never had any opportunity. We really didn't have horses. For the most part, we had a couple, but they just plowed the garden. That's all it was. We didn't own a tractor. We actually plowed the garden with a horse. We didn't have a lot, but we had enough growing up. And I went to college a couple of years on a full ride. And then after that, I got actually into the aerospace industry. And I was actually sitting behind a desk wearing khaki pants and a collared shirt when I decided to quit my job and take everything I had and move out west to be a cowboy.
Really?
Yes. Yes, sir. And I couldn't ride a speed horse. I'll tell you that right now.
Well, none of us could when we first started. Sticky people are born to do stuff. That's pretty cool, man. I didn't know that. That's funny. And we met, I guess, now that I've seen your face on the other side of the camera here, I remember you now. It's hard to remember that far back for me sometimes. But we came up there, man. That would have been like pre-COVID. That would have been like 2020 Yeah, that was a long time ago.
I don't remember exactly when it was, but Amanda that had the Western store, you know, the Hero Ranch Western Wear that carries your ropes, she asked if I would host a clinic there at my place, at my barn. It was indoors, and the weather here can be sketchy. And you guys come up and put on a nice clinic, and I got to see you guys teach and be around you. I already knew of you from the internet. I had seen your content, but that's when I met you, and I think we all went out to eat, your dad and I, and you went to the Mexican place that night.
Yep. That's right. We always end up going to a Mexican place on the clinics. That's like, there's one everywhere. It's like every time. So where'd you go work in Arizona? Did you like it out there?
It was very interesting. I'm a very precise and calculated person, but for some reason I went on a whim with a dream, and I had met my first wife at the time, and we knew each other for a while, and we moved out to her family's ranch in Snowflake, Arizona. It's northern Arizona, just south of the interstate, right before you get to Flagstaff. It's back south a little bit. It's high desert, and I had never even been to Arizona. I seen Arizona for the first time when I peered over the couch the next morning when I woke up. I didn't go check it out before I went. I thought I had a job. I did not have a job when I went out there. I had a horse that was supposed to be a hit. I knew nothing. You got to understand, I was 20 years old and knew nothing. But I mean, I was very ignorant, but I had a dream. And I took a horse that I had bought that someone told me was a head horse. And this horse was 14 hands high. And I didn't know a head horse had to be bigger. I was very ignorant. And I moved out there. with basically the horse, a saddle, and a dream. And I lived on the ranch there, and basically my horsemanship improved a ton there. I started as a team roper. I wanted to rope, and I had a hard time. I could rope, but I couldn't ride. And that was a big problem. So by working on the ranch out there and, you know, catching some wild cattle and stuff like that, that helped my riding immensely, because out there, it's not loping across the field. You're jumping tumbleweeds and everything else as you're roping and dodging holes. But that's what I started doing out there, and taking colts to ride.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. So how long did you stay out there?
I was out there for around 4 to 5 years. And then before I ended up, and between there, I had been in Texas and Kansas a little bit off and on, but very short lived, and then ended up back here. Oh, I mean, I started that endeavor in 2000, and that's when I started my horsemanship journey and training horses. And I've been doing it ever since. And I ended up back here permanently in 2004 sometime.
So tell me a little bit about your folks, your dad. Like, I mean, if you didn't really have horses, you know what I mean? Like, was your dad a good dude? Like, did you have a good foundation? Because taking a leap like that is, you kind of got to be pretty confident. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I was not confident. I was an introvert. I will tell you that. But like I said, I had the dream to go on, but not a lot of thought behind it. And my dad is still, he's a CEO of an aerospace company. He's been in the aerospace industry all his life. My dad's managed people and done stuff of that nature his entire life, very successful at it. My mom was very successful. She always managed lots of people. She worked for Walmart for quite some time in the insurance department, and then for a company called Outdoor Cap that makes a lot of hats, the ball caps that are out there. And they were very always in leadership roles. And my dad, mom, there was no horses. There was no horses in my family at all. But I was always infatuated from a young age of horses. I mean, if I would have came to your house and you had horses, I would have pestered you to maybe pet them or ride them. I would have bothered you. I mean, it's been in me since the start. And I played sports in school, competitive. I played basketball and baseball. My dad played sports like crazy. I mean, he played 500 softball games a year. And that's where
Good
we grew up.
We
grew up at ball games every weekend in tournaments. That's what we did. No rodeo or anything. And so I came into this very green and naive from a totally different outlook. And I credit that to the fact that I can teach, because you didn't have to change the way I done things by how my grandpa did it or my dad did it or anybody. I didn't have any of that. I was getting VHS tapes at the time. That's all that was available. And then I would just, the horse probably, I've learned from a lot of people, but the horse taught me more than anything, because I started training horses for the public, and whatever they dropped off, that's what I rode. I didn't ever even ask if it had papers or what it was. I mean, they're liable to bring a Shire, an Arabian, a walking horse, or a quarter horse. It didn't matter. And by 2000,
just trying to eat.
Just trying to eat. Basically, I've done it for $330 a month. That's what I got to train a horse, and that's. I mean, it was bologna and cheese, and never. I mean, pretty much was broke all the time, and no insurance. Just so whatever I did, I had to be good. I had to be careful about it, but I had to produce a product, and so by about 2006. I had started right around 500 colts for the public on whatever people drop off. And that taught me probably more than any one individual thing or person, the horse itself.
That's crazy. So was your dad like, did he prepare you for this? Like, or like, did he work just all the, it sounds like he played a lot of ball, but like, I mean, I always think about it in the sense of, and this is the heart behind the question, okay? This is important to know, I think, for the listeners and for you. So I don't think being critical of your parents in the essence of to whine about it is productive. I think that's stupid. But I think as adult men, it's important for us to look at our fathers, their fathers, and the fathers before them and go, okay, I love you and I honor you and I'm proud that you're my dad. But just like every human on earth, you have dropped the ball in some areas of life. And I personally want to learn from those areas of life. And so I look at somebody, and a lot of guys I have on here have a very much so Jonah in the whales type story. They're like, God was asking me to do something, but I just ran from it. You know, it's like classic, like the last five guests. That's kind of what it's been. And I find great value in looking into my forefathers' lives and going, okay, what were the great things we did? And what were the opportunities we missed when it comes to your children or my children or me? And it's been very helpful for me kind of navigating what God wants me to be as a father and a husband. So that's why I asked the question, because it sounds like your dad is wildly successful. And so have my forefathers. They've all been successful, like people that people like, and they're like, hey, he's a great guy. But I find a lot of times as men, what we do is we find these goals, and then the goals that the world says are really good things, and then we sacrifice our family for those on accident. We don't even know that we were doing it. It's like, I'm going to be the best damn softball player ever. I'm going to be the best leader in an aerospace place. But my son grows up with all of these questions of like, I have an affinity for horses, but no one is helping me find this. So I'm going to grab my saddle and go across the country and figure it out. You know what I mean?
Yes, sir. And that's kind of what happened. So my dad, you know, due to my dad's success, you know, everything has a price, you know, everything has a price, and some people aren't willing to sacrifice, or however you want to put it. But yeah, he was not around a ton. That he also hunted and fished all the time. And, of course, mom had to work too, because we, like I said, we didn't have a lot. My grandparents lived on each side of me, my great grandparents and my grandparents on each side of me. And there were three room houses, and there was no plumbing. Mm-hmm. Whatsoever. No plumbing in the house. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had an outhouse. I mean, it was very poor. You know, we grew up in a trailer house, and I had two sisters, and there was two bedrooms in the whole home, you know? Mm-hmm. And so dad was out working, trying to provide. And also my mom was 16. My dad was 18, 19 when I was born. So he was a young man. So all mm-hmm. the softball and stuff, I would imagine he was spending time with his friends. You know, he was spending a lot of time. Mm-hmm. He was still a young man also, but he always provided for us. And then at 17, they got divorced. Mm-hmm. And that was prom night my senior year. You know, they got divorced. But the thing about my mom and dad's divorce that I got from it that really helped me in my life is my mom and dad never bickered or talked bad about one another. They never did it.
Yeah.
They mm-hmm. they never spoke illy of one another, and they went on, and they still come to family functions and everything. And that meant a lot to us kids, you know, mm-hmm. to go on. And I feel like everybody is born with a desire and kind of a dream. I think 99.9% of people never achieve that because of they don't want to suffer or because they think of money first. In other words, at my clinics I've taught before, I've told people, I said, if it might not be with horses, but if I can help you achieve anything, it would be whatever your dream is. Because I think God puts that in us, and then he gives us talents and things to complement it along the way. Now it's up to us to do it. It's totally mm-hmm. up to us. And I think if you're right, I tell people at the clinic to write if you can do anything in the world and it all pays $100 million a year, what would it be? Well, that takes money out of it. So people are very transparent. And I say, write mm-hmm. it on a piece of paper. And after they write it down, we talk some more. And then I say, okay, I want you guys to, if you're doing now what's on that piece of paper, I want you to raise your hand. And rarely, but it does happen. Do people raise their hand? Because they're not mm-hmm. doing what's on that piece of paper. And they'll mm-hmm. have all the excuses in the world. And so I have felt a calling from the beginning to be involved in the Western industry with horses. It didn't look like I should be in that industry. And I didn't mm-hmm. know some of the things I was doing along the way. It didn't make sense. But I'm here to teach and to add value to people. And it's not necessarily always to teach about horses, but I mean, I had a girl come for lessons this morning, and we probably talked more about her career than we talked about the lesson. And I want people to go and do what they're put here on earth, because God put us all here to do something. Mm-hmm. He really did. But we have to answer up and do it. We have to do it. And they're suffering.
Mm-hmm. If you're going to be good at anything, you're going to suffer for it. Period.
Everything. And there's things that are hard on your body. You know, I don't start colts as much anymore. There's two young ladies at my barn that train independently, and I've turned it over to them. They work out of my barn, but they don't work for me unless I hire them to start a colt for me. But I mentor them. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to go to work for me, and I told them it would be better for them to just let me mentor them, and they could just board there. I said, you're going to need help along the way. But one of them is living a dream. She quit her job in management at Walmart and came to me at 30, I don't know, she was 30-something years old, had a family, and she says, I want to go to work for you and train horses. And I said, I could hire you, but you'll starve to death because I can't afford to pay you probably what you're worth. I said, but if you'll come train out of here, you can board your horses here and I'll help you. And she's still training. Mm-hmm. She's been here, I think, 5-6 years.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any times, if you think back to 19, when you got in the truck and drove to Arizona to now, did you have any times in there where you were like, dude, I just want to quit. Like, this sucks. I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah. So the closest I had to that was probably in about 2002, right around there. I had made a mistake that I learned from, and I had, me and my wife at the time, we had taken too many horses to ride, and we were overloaded, and it was just too much, especially without an indoor in this neck of the woods. You have to have an indoor here or you'll about starve to death just due to the weather and the wet weather and the mud. And we were just overworking ourselves. And I was very close between that and a very fractious relationship. I was very close to going back to the aerospace industry, because all along this aerospace industry had, due to my dad's connections in it, has been offered back to me several times. And there was many times it's been offered, and it was a very great job. And there was many times in my horsemanship journey that early on that I didn't even have more than $500 to my name. But I was just I'm kind of very hard headed. And I was just I felt like if I step out of purpose in what God had me here to do, then I think you're treading on some pretty thin water right there. Thin ground. I don't think that's a very good deal. I think you should stay in your purpose. I had a pretty big business idea here about 2 or 3, 4 years ago, and it's still a great idea. But what kept me from it is because I prayed about it and I thought about it, and it's not my purpose. It's great money. It could make a lot of wealth, but it's not what I'm supposed to be here doing. And it might be later for me in life, but it's not now. And I
call those,
you're living your purpose.
Yeah, no doubt. I call those death roads. So, and death roads is probably not a great name, but that's what they are. It's there's all these paths you can take in life, and some of them are obviously bad. Don't go do meth. Obviously a death road. But another example of a death road would be prioritizing your career over your family. And there's a lot of people in the world. There's a lot of people on TikTok telling you that as a man, that's what you should do. And it is a road full of death. And that's what you will get at the end of it. Almost everything my flesh wants to do is a death road. Almost everything. Like, I find myself craving, like, for instance, all of my cowboy friends, if I put a GoPro on this hat, get on a horse in Wyoming and doctor cows, there are hundreds of thousands of people on the internet that are going to tell me good job. My flesh wants that. I want to get on a horse in Wyoming and go do that. Is that what's best for my family? No, it's not. I have little kids right now. They need me bad. That is what Dalton wants to do. Dalton wants to go doctor cows in Wyoming. Dalton does not get to go do that because that's a death road. And my sons are not going to watch a freaking YouTube video of me and go, that's my dad, if I don't have a relationship with him. It's not going to happen. Right. Now, in 10 years, like you said, down the road, it might be something that they want to go do and that we go do together. And that's a life road. That's different, right? And so there's all these choices that we get to pick from. And what I find visiting with people older than me, people younger than me, people my age, is that men in and of themselves learn to not walk down the death road by walking down the death road. And so most guys spend their 20s, 20 to 35, running down all these rabbit trails. I can make money doing this. I can freaking do this. This is a great job. Yada, yada, yada. And they're coming home to a pissed off wife, resentful kids, right? A family that doesn't understand because you're choosing something else over than us, and we're supposed to be the most important. And then somewhere from 30 to 35, a smart man looks up and goes, why does my life suck so bad? Like, why do I hate what I do even though I make a lot of money? Why? Because there's no life there. There's no life there. Jesus is not asking you to do that. And while you do have a really nice truck, you have nothing of actual value, you know? And it's funny to me because I can name mine. And I'm planning on kind of my goal over the next 6 months is to kind of map out a book. And the book is simply going to be lessons learned over the last 15 years of my life. It probably even more, probably last 20 years of my life. Is just a chronicle of like screwing up is part of the game, but learning from the failure is the key. And I think I'm going to name it Death Roads because that's what they all were for me. Baseball, fishing, cowboy into a certain degree. There's a lot of things that I put my identity in that just led to death for me. And it's interesting because you saying that, it's like it's a really good idea. You can make a lot of money with it. But you recognizing that, like, that's not what God's got for me right now. You know what I mean?
Right. I just think it's just really important to stay close to the, you know, and only you know what you're put here to do. I mean, only mm-hmm. you know. I mean, no one else can tell you that. It's just like my wife. One time I was talking to her driving through a small town over here, and I said, what did you want to be as a little kid? She said, well, I always wanted to be an astronaut, but you know, who could be an astronaut? And we were driving by a small town right over here, not far from here. And I said, that's funny you say that. She said, well, why is that? I said, see that house right there? She said, yeah. I said, so the girl that grew up right there is an astronaut right now. And I told her her name. And she said, are you serious? And I said, yes. But I said, so many people, they shut their own dreams off before they have a chance. And then there's others that go after the love of the wrong idol, like money, of course, or mm-hmm. pride. Like yep. of course, you mentioned, you know, seeing people liking all your posts and all your videos. I mean, but that's mm-hmm. just human nature. We're going to, our sinful nature will gear towards that. And we're all guilty of it. I mean, I had a time in my life after I had a divorce and it's just nothing, but I mean, I've heard you mention on your podcast about alcohol and I drank more and went out and just didn't focus on what I was put here to do. And, fortunately that all ran a circle and I came back to more of who I truly am. And I think we have to do that to find value. It's just like telling a young 18-year-old what he should do. Well, even if he did listen, there wouldn't be any value in it because he's never tested the waters. And mm-hmm. I compare it a lot to a horse. If a horse wants to go to the gate or wherever, or to his buddy, you're better off to allow that 1,000-1,200-pound animal to go there. Because he's got his mind on it anyway. Allow him to go there, but just give him something to do when he's there. Just get what mm-hmm. you want done, you know, while you're there, and then come back over and release his mind back over where you want it to be. And I think people are the same way. I think there's so many parallels with people and horses, and horses have taught me more about people than people have taught me about people.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with that wholeheartedly. All of my fathering principles, like all of them, are horsemanship principles. Like every bit of them. It's like pressure and release, freaking air, hair, skin, bone. You know what I mean? Like make the right thing easy and the wrong thing hard. Like I look at my kid like he is a colt, you know? And it works, yeah, dude. It freaking works.
It does. It works. My wife gets tired of hearing it. I said, hey, look, this is just like horse training. She rolls her eyes.
Yes.
But that's fine.
It is. It's the same thing. It's communicating with something that doesn't understand your voice. It doesn't understand how you're talking to it. And so I find it easier now that my kid's getting a little older. But like, you know, just like making the right thing easy and the wrong thing hard is a huge thing for a kid. It's like, hey, I can leave this here and tell you not to touch it, even though you want to touch it, and then spank you every time you touch it, which is annoying for me and annoying for you. Or I can just make the right thing easy and the wrong thing hard and remove it from your reach. And now none of us have to deal with it, you know? And it's the same with a horse. It's the same thing.
It is. Yeah. I got a kick out of when I have a 10-year-old, and when she was about probably 4 or 5 years old, I caught my wife one time. I heard her said her name's Mesa, and she said, Mesa, will you bring me a paper towel? And Mesa said, no, thank you. I said, so now what are you going to do? I said, so the thing of it is, to me, is at that point in time, you shouldn't be asking. You said, hey, bring me a paper towel, please, at the end of it. Mm-hmm. That would be a better way to say that. Because otherwise, what are you going to do? You're leaving it up to them. And then when they are polite back to you, what do you do?
And yeah,
it's very similar to that in horses too. We're their leaders. We shouldn't try to dominate them. We can't. They're just too big if it really comes down to it. But I think we need to just, we need to try to get them to buy in with their mind to things and just make it, like you said, the wrong thing difficult, the right thing easy, and get them to choose. I talk to a lot about a door. I'd rather open a door and a horse go through it than him get up to the hallway and look through the door. Then I slam the door on his rear and shove him through it. Mm-hmm. I'd rather open the door and him come through than to slam a door on his rear and push him through. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is, say we show horses a lot. What happens is, in the show world, you're being judged on very small markers. I mean, you have to do things within a very short distance and preciseness, especially in a ranch trail pattern. And so what happens is, when you have to count on that horse for it to be his idea and help you, well, he'll let you down because you've always imposed your will on him. And it shows up. And what the horse will do, he will get the job done, but it won't look very good. And the finesse leaves, and then it reflects on the scorecard.
No, that makes perfect sense. You got it. My dad would say to me all the time, you got to make your idea his idea. And see, that's the problem with horsemanship, dude. Is so the question that comes after that is how, right? Well, that's learned by sitting on your saddle for about 4 billion hours. And then maybe right before you die, you'll be like, I got a little something figured out. But I just never, man, like, I get along okay with what I get, you know, and I'm pretty excited. So I'm trying to set up. So my goal, I'm going to start a YouTube series. And I'm going to try to set up a ranch roping clinic, have someone host a clinic in all 50 states in the United States. And then I'm going to film every single one of them, like get to know the host and all the people and make a video out of every clinic. And because of the craziness of my schedule, I'm just going to fly in and ride whatever they give me. And okay. I've done this a couple of times now, where I go to these clinics and I just borrow a horse and bring my saddle or whatever. And I'm pretty excited because that's 50 different horses that you get to go and ride and do. Like, it's not just get up there and trot a circle. You know what I mean? Like, you got to freaking do something with these things. And the last clinic I did, they were so awesome, man. It was Gracie Torres. And I told him, and I tell everybody this, I'm like, don't cut me a freaking bronc, man, because I can't ride one that farts hard. You know what I mean? Like, I'm coming off of there. And so she was like, oh, no, we're not going to cut you a bronc. So I show up, dude. They put me on this freaking kid's horse. I'm talking about they are training children how to ride with this thing, okay? So very, very dull, broke horse. And so the second day of the clinic, we're kind of not wrapping it up, but we had just roped a few or whatever, and the horse was doing fine. The only little sticky spot we had was if I got real tight, like faced up, he would start rearing up on you a little bit, like cheating you, like trying to get off of the pressure, you know? And so I'd just feed rope and kind of keep them put together, and like I'd end up like wicked long on a heel shot because he would start acting up or whatever. And so one of the students was like, hey, can you demo a doctoring one by yourself? And I was like, okay. You know, and I've doctored stuff by myself on like colts or horses that I had rode a lot, you know, but there's really one spot when you're doctoring alone that you don't want to get left in a bind. And it's when you step off, like you need your horse to hold the rope. Like bad. Do not cheat me right here, you know? And so I got up there and these calves were probably weighing 600 pounds. They were just some, you know, rope and steers, basically dummies with hide on them, which makes it pretty challenging because they don't want to move. And man, this horse he did okay. It took me longer than I wanted to get the thing tripped. But when I got up there, I'm sitting there, I'm talking, there's probably 30 people sitting there watching you, you know? And I was like, okay, so this is the problem I've been having with this horse since I got here. I cannot have that problem right now. And it doesn't look like it would be a big problem in here because it's not. If this calf gets up in this arena, it's not a big deal. But if I was in a 10,000 acre pasture, and this horse let me down, once I step off, we're going to have a serious issue coming. Because now I'm going to get my butt whooped. The calf's going to run off with my freaking rope. And old Seabiscuit here is running off. You know what I mean? So when you step down, it's very important that your horse knows his job. And the horse did fine. I had to back him up once or twice. And the way I did it is I stepped off and I kept the end of my rope. I normally tie off and then get down and doctor. But I kept the end of my rope. That way, if he went to rearing up, I could feed rope. Or if he cheated me and like walked too far forward, I could snatch it down on the horn and tighten it back up. And so I was able to kind of get by it. And so, but with these clinics, man, you never know what somebody's going to put you on, you know? And so I think it'll be a really interesting part of that video series because it's just like learning how to communicate with hundreds of different horses. It's hard, man. And it's a neat thing to learn. And it goes with the podcast. It's like, I'm not the greatest horseman on earth. I can get by stuff. You know what I mean? And get my job done typically. But I think it'll be a really cool part of that video series where people can watch me like literally take a horse that I've never seen before, get on them and try to do a job with them. You know what I mean?
That will be fun, I would say. You'll have a good time.
Gotta be. Yeah, gotta look at it like that.
I can't wait to watch every bit of it.
It might be rated R. This son of a buck.
Yeah, that's harder than you think, and people don't understand. And a lot of those horses are, I call them sunny and 70 horses. And they're really good if it's sunny and 70. But the instant, you know, you go to asking or calling upon them, sometimes things goes awry. And with clinics, like you said, you've seen a lot of things at clinics and we've seen a lot of things at clinics. I mean, but that's why people come to them. They come for help. I mean, I've had people in clinics with the curb strap over the nose of the horse and they wonder why the horse is bad in the face. I've seen bits upside down. Upside down. I have seen people come and they say my horse just bucks all the time when I ride it. And I look down and there's no hobble strap.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even know they're supposed to have a hobble strap. And I'm like, yeah, where I came from is, I mean, I knew nothing. I mean, knew absolutely nothing on how to start a colt or ride a horse. I've got a picture at my barn over there where I ride. And there's a picture of me on my first Colt ever. And I've got a tank top, a pair of gloves on. This is summertime. A pair of gloves on, a pair of tennis shoes, and my toes are sticking straight down. And no hat on, and nylon reins, and I'm riding this Colt. And I mean, I look at it. Lord have mercy. I put it up because I want people to understand when they say there's no help for me and they say, I can't do it. You don't know how bad I am. I said, look, you see that picture? For some reason, I thought it would be a good idea to quit my job and sell all my worldly belongings other than a saddle and bought a horse that wasn't fit to do what I was wanting to do with it and move 1,160 miles away. And I looked like that. I couldn't ride at a trot without holding on to the horn. And I would bleed. My legs would bleed. I would bleed places. And if I asked someone, how do you keep that from happening? They would just say, you just got to learn to ride better. I said, there's got to be a process in this. And so when I teach people.
You got better tip, Bill?
Yeah. And so when I teach people, I have a lot of empathy. Especially when people want to learn to rope, because in our ranch classes, you have to, as far as the roping goes, you have to be able to rope a station. Most of the time, it's a stationary dummy. So we're judged on, you come across this obstacle course, if you will, and you just basically, you have to trot or lope up to or walk up to a dummy, and you have to take your rope down and you rope a stationary dummy. And you're judged not as much on if you catch or not, that's bonus points, but it's more like, did your horse waller around? Did you go up there and stop and the horse never move and you stopped in a good spot and how you handle your rope and all that. And so I'm teaching a lot of 50, 60 year old ladies how to do that. And they've never swung a rope in their life. And, and I've seen some wrecks. I mean, we had a horse show 2 years ago. There was a lady in her 80s, and she was at the other end of the arena in the trail course, and the warm-up pin is in the other part of the arena, and the only thing dividing
Jason,
is cone.
Hey, Jason, hang on just a second. My kid is screaming like a banshee outside.
Yeah, that's fine.
Good heavens.
Oh, my gosh. I'm just watching. I've got the cow horse, Tulsa. They're going down the fence up here in Tulsa, and I've been watching it.
Oh, very good. We got a pond. Yeah, it's fine. We got a pond about 100 yards from our house, probably. And Bro Dog was on his first solo fishing mission. And he got hung up. And he's down there screaming. And I could hear, I was like, what is he screaming about? And I was like, well, the dog fell in and drowned. He freaking got hooked, you know, like something happened. He was hung in a tree and couldn't get it undone. But you can't see. You can't see through the woods. Like, you got to go all the way down there to see even where he's at, you know.
That's
dadgummit. Okay, so where were we at? You were telling something about a show.
So I was telling you kind of what I have to deal with a little bit, you know, on teaching the clinics and the why I focus on safety. We were at a show, a quarter horse show, and they have a trail course going on. And so half of the arena is the trail course. The other half is a warm-up pin with about 16, 17 horses. And the only thing dividing it is cones. There's just a set of cones going down through there. Well, at the far end of the arena is a log drag. And there's a gal that's about 80 years old. She's about 80, and she goes down there, and she walks up to the drag. She grabs a rope, and she dallies. And when she dallies, her horse steps over the rope. And so she's got the log hooked on to the horn, and then she takes off going forward, and that hits that horse in the sheath area. And it takes off, and she just grabs the horn with both hands and slumps over the horn. And you guessed it, the horse just runs away through the trail course with the log tied on behind it and comes through the warm-up pen, just running all over through everybody. Everybody's screaming and shutting the gates and everything. And safety, and I ended up bailing off. I was on a young horse. I bailed off, and I got on the log while he's going by, and I cut the rope, and everything was end up being fine. And but that kind of little stuff in safety is what a lot of people need. they take it for granted on how dangerous it can get really fast. And they just don't understand how dangerous, especially when you involve ropes.
Mm-hmm. Well, half of being good at all of it is knowing how to keep your horse out of a bind. Yes. Looking for things just like that and knowing, like if my rope gets under my horse's tail, we're about to have a problem. This is going to be a problem. And so many people don't even know what that is. You know what I'm saying? And that's a hard part about roping with beginners or novice people or intermediate people is if they don't know what a rimfire is, then they don't know they're rimfiring you. So even if you're handy and you're riding something kind of green and a guy rimfires you, you're getting bucked off anyway. And knowing to keep a guy out of a pickle is half the battle. So that's cool, man. So how many kids do you have, Jason?
I've got two. I have a 19-year-old and I have a 10-year-old.
Okay, cool. You spread them way out. Are you glad you did that?
I did. Yeah. Well, I had my first one is with my first wife, which was the host of your clinic. That was Amanda.
Mm-hmm.
And then my second one's with Carrie, my current wife, and she's 10. And you know, they get along great. And of course, the two families, we get along great. As a matter of fact, my daughter now is with my other daughter and my ex-wife, but they're all at the pool today together.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot of stuff together and get along great. And I just attribute that to, you know, my parents got along and I think it's just better for the kids that everybody can still be friends.
Mm-hmm. And your wife is, she's a horse trainer as well.
So she's a dental hygienist 4 days a week. And then she Fridays through Friday, Saturday, Sunday, she's either at the show or helping teach or showing horses or coaching non-pros and stuff also. But she works in Northwest Arkansas. She's a dental hygienist for 4 days a week. Yeah. She also has a leather shop. She builds a lot of leather stuff. She has second calf leather and she does a lot of leather stuff and works every evening in her shop also.
Golly, she sounds like a busy lady.
She's a busy lady. Yes, she is. Yeah.
That's good. In Proverbs 31, that says, find you a wife that works diligently with her hands. I have also found a wife that does this. She is very busy as well.
Yes. Yes. She's a good one. She's very busy. COVID kind of sparked the leather deal. She got involved in a leather around that time, right around 2020. She grew up showing horses at a high level. Not training, but showing horses. And she traveled the United States and showed in English and Western.
Okay, cool. Well, if you were talking to your 20-year-old self, what would you tell that guy?
Well, I think a big thing that people will ask if you change anything, but, you know, I would still want, I would probably want to still have the amount of horses under me and everything like that to do what I'm doing right now. But it sure helps a lot if you can get a good mentor and spend 4 to 6 years with a good mentor along the way. I don't want to say it fast tracks it, but wisdom, when you can learn wisdom from people, you know, or some knowledge that later becomes wisdom for you, it sure helps a lot. I don't know that I would change a whole lot because where I am now is because what I did then, but I made mistakes along the way. But the biggest thing probably would be just work harder and not take so long to mature in work ethic. I felt like I took a long time to mature in work ethic. It took quite a long time. And as you know, cause you have your own business. When you are an entrepreneur and have your own business, you sure don't look at it by the hourly scale. You don't ever want to do that or you'll be depressed. But there's a lot of reward in it. And I wished I would have worked harder earlier, in order to, I guess get a jump on it and not be such a late developer in life. And I say late developer, I mean, it was really not, but it was a very slow build for me with a lot of suffering and a lot of, bologna and cheese sandwiches and not knowing, how you're going to pay your bills next month. It was a lot of that for very many years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now, I mean, I would have never dreamed, you know, in 06, I went to work for the place I'm at now for a guy that owned a pharmacy, and basically I become the breeder, the trainer, and the ranch manager. And they were the best people. The Whitleys were the best to work for. I worked for them until I bought this place. And it would have been probably, I think, in 19. I worked for them from 06 to 19. And mm-hmm. and then they retired and they sold it to me. And I could not be where I'm at now without the help of them, among many, many others that helped me along the way. But I never dreamed that I would be able to own my own horse facility. It just didn't mm-hmm. seem obtainable.
Oh, 100%. Is there anything that you, any key moments you can think back to that changed your work ethic that you were like, okay, it's time to lock in?
Yeah. Well, some stuff reminded me of work ethic. So I tell people along the way, you're going to do things that are unrelated to maybe where you're at now. But I had to go back and revisit some things I'd had through high school. And I will say that, as funny as it sounds, basketball taught me to come from the bottom to come to a higher level from the very bottom of, like, we'll just say the C team, in order mm-hmm. and all the way up to being a starter. And had I not had that experience in sports, I would have probably quit a long time ago, because I see so often now that when kids are unsuccessful, the parents are so quick to go to bat for them and make excuses and blame coaches and everything else. And I don't agree with that. I agree with them, people being able to have bad coaches early, have struggles early, and be treated unfairly early, because here's the deal, life isn't fair. And once you get over that, the rest is pretty good. And you got to understand that life is not fair. And I think that through perseverance, through ball, just to know that I came on and basically, you know, I basically went to every practice, put all the time in for 2 years and never got any playing time. And then finally I did. And it transpired to a starting position later on. And that always stuck with me in horses. But it took a while for me to go back to that and draw from that. And I wish I'd have drew from that a little earlier versus later. As far as that, mm-hmm. I mean, I think you need to be a grinder, and I think mm-hmm. you need to be a grinder, and it's consistency, and it's discipline, and it's not motivation, because motivation comes and goes.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that. I have a similar, experience playing baseball that was like, it's a pivotal moment in really, it was like this pivotal moment in my initiation into the what kind of man I was going to end up being. And you don't know that at the time. Like, it's just insignificant. At the time, it really sucks. But then as you get older, you start recognizing that you equate everything back to this one pivotal thing, this one moment. Mm-hmm. Mine was blocking baseballs, like learning how to block a baseball as a catcher. I was terrified of the ball. I was terrified of it. And my dad tied my hands behind my back and pegged me with baseballs until I wanted him to do it. Like, till I was not scared. I ain't scared of nothing hitting me anymore. And I went from this little kid. I was probably 13. I was going into ninth grade and I wanted to play baseball and I wasn't good enough. I just knew I wasn't good enough. And my dad was like, well, they'll always take a catcher. You just got to know how to block the ball. And the second he recognized that I was scared of it, it was over with. So he had me in some like 1980s catching gear, like didn't fit at all, tied my freaking hands behind my back and went to hosing me down with them things until I was like, do it again, do it again, do it again. And it was a shift in what I was going to end up being. And I didn't know that. I dang sure was the best ball blocking son of a gun around. Like, I wanted him to throw it in the dirt with the guy on third. Like, I thought it was cool. And I've hung my hat on that for a long time. Of like, when I experience difficult things in my life, I just say, it's just like blocking balls. It's just like blocking balls. Riding 25 mile circles on just a shitter, just a terrible horse. And it's just like blocking balls, you know? And I can, you know, if you're speaking to another guy that's trying to find his identity or who he is as a man, that comes from Christ. your role as a father, in my opinion, is to manufacture these situations for your children. Now, I'm not saying take your kid out and peg him with baseballs, but I'm saying look for the fear in their heart and speak truth to it. And that's it. The story sounds very like harsh, like, oh my gosh, this guy was pegging his kid with baseballs and he's glad he did it, you know? But if you speak to the heart behind it, the heart behind it as a father looking at a 13-year-old son is you're fearful of something that you can conquer. And I'm going to teach you right now how to conquer it. And that is going to require great and terrible suffering in your brain. If I had to compare blocking baseballs to what I suffer now, it's not even close. Like, please, if I could trade what I have now for getting hit with a baseball, no question. But as you watch your children grow, and you introduce them into these situations where they have to learn how to grind, learn how to be resilient, learn how to push through, it's not fun. It's very hard to do. Like, you don't want to do it. You're like, I just want to save you. You know what I mean?
It's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think as parents, so much time and I'm really good friends with a guy that retired from coaching girls basketball, varsity basketball, for I think 20 something years. And we have mm-hmm. a lot of visits on this stuff here. And, you know, one of the biggest reasons of getting out of coaching that it's the biggest turnoff is dealing with the new parents nowadays, that they, mm-hmm. they don't want to let their kids be coached and grow. And I think sports are majority of people in sports and kids in sports, they don't go on to be college athletes, a majority, but there's so much other value they can get from it that they'll apply to the rest of their life. Just like me, I was not a college mm-hmm. athlete, but it still taught me something that allowed me to, you know, go forward in my life and use it later and to grow. And without mm-hmm. it, I don't know, you know, what if I would have quit? If I would have quit due to, you know, going to 2 years worth of practices and never stepping on the floor, what would that have looked like in my horse career? Would I have went to Arizona and then after 2 weeks just come home with my tail between my legs and be in the mm-hmm. aerospace industry now? Would I have a nice home and all this money? Probably, I don't know. I don't know where I would be. But the fact of the matter is, that's not what I'm put here to be in. And this isn't dress rehearsal here. We get one. Mm-hmm. This is one shot. And we only have one shot to raise our kids, too. And it's not like we get to practice and then have our kids and then try to do it right. We're learning mm-hmm. as we go there also. But yeah. I try to keep in mind that we can be their friend once they're 18, but we're their leader until then. We're their mm-hmm. leader, and we should lead them in a way in which they should go and to teach them. And sometimes teaching them lets them struggle as long as they're not in bad harm or anything. But I see kids so much that have parents go to bat every time a teacher does something or a coach does something. Here comes mom and dad running up to the school. Well, what's going to happen when they go to get a job in the workforce? There's going to be hazing in that workforce. There's going to be mm-hmm. real life things happen. And that's life. And you can't yeah. get away from it. But what you can do is prepare them for it while they're under your roof so that when they do come home at night, you can talk to them about it and help them understand how to deal with it in a manner that they do stand up for themselves and they're not a victim, you know, mm-hmm. and they're not a sheep, you know, and stuff like that. And I think it's very important to do that in order to produce, another generation of quality citizens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the biggest roadblock I've found when it comes to good parenting or just even having the ability to apply the parenting principles that are needed to make a well-rounded young man or young woman is how screwed up people are from their own childhood and learning how to deal with that and look at it in a way that isn't just traumatic. Obviously some situations are worse than others, but the fact of the matter is that at some point in a man's life, if he's going to choose to take a bride, if he's going to choose to, bring kids into this world, he's got to look down his past and go, I forgive everybody that did everything to me. God has a plan for me and I just need to be the best son of a gun I can be for his purpose for me. And I think a lot of people that listen to this podcast have found themselves in that situation. I think they're looking in the mirror every morning after they brush their teeth and going, what the fuck am I doing here, man? Like, what is the point? You know, I got these three kids, I got this wife, and I feel like a child. Well, you feel like a child because your father failed you. You know, you feel like a child because no one initiated you into manhood, and your father in heaven is trying to do that. But if you don't recognize it, if you can't turn loose all this shit that happened to you 20 years ago, you're just going to screw your kid up. And so when we start defining what a man is, a smart man realizes really fast that he cannot do it without the king. And a dumb one takes a long time. That'd be me. And the fact of the matter is these people don't know how to fill that hole in their heart. They're like, I don't understand how I'm supposed to do this. And the world tells us not to say anything. And so we don't. And that's why guys go drive off in a parking lot and shoot themselves in the head. That's why guys freaking snort it up their nose or drink it. And or you can insert a good habit. That's why they spend all their time at work or all their time at the gym, because they're scared to go home and have these conversations with their wife. They're fearful of having a deep emotional relationship with their sons. They just are. And that's the enemy. And he is damn good at his job. And he's done a good job. It's terrible.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, I couldn't agree more with it. And I think that just people, if they stay close to their purpose, it's kind of like a horse on a cow. I mean, if he's focused on that cow and his job, all the distractions you're riding past are a lot less of a distraction because he's focused on his job. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to be focused on whatever we're put here to do. And everybody knows what it is. We might not want to admit it to ourselves, and we might not think it's achievable, or it's not me. But I look at it as, why not you? That's all I say, you know? I mean, why not you? There's a lot of people that are miserable and snorting the stuff up their nose and you know, putting a gun to their head because they're just not happy. But if you think about it, I believe we're conditioned from an early age to not go out and think for ourselves, but to be factory workers, if you will. There's nothing wrong with that. I've been a factory worker, you know, early on, you know, in college, but we're kind of conditioned through school and stuff, I believe, to do that. You know, we go in, they tell us off bells and all the buzzers, when to eat, you know, when to be there 8 hours a day, and you've met your quota. And so when we graduate and roll into the workforce, that's just what you do. And you feel that's the most comfortable thing you've done. It's not entrepreneurship. You know, they don't teach any of that. And I think I think it's sad, because I think the more you can get people fulfilling their purpose, the other things kind of fall into place. There's not all that white noise. It's similar to horses. Someone comes and says, hey, I've got this horse and he flips his nose when I back him up. I said, okay, go to back him up by pulling the slack out of the reins. Well, he don't. And I said, your horse doesn't have a flipping his nose problem. When you pull on the reins, his feet don't reach backwards. So don't worry about the head. Just get him to where when you lift on the reins, his feet, when they back up, just let go. And pretty soon the head and neck will fall in where it needs to be, because the feet are supple. You pull the reins, he backs his feet up. You don't have to worry about the head and neck. But everybody wants to look at the theatrics of what's going on. And I think that's what's wrong in society a lot. We get distracted by all the theatrics, especially with social media, and we get away from the main focus of things, and I call it the meat and potatoes, or the fundamentals. And that's why horsemanship's so neat to me. If you know, my horse doesn't stop. No, it's not that he don't stop. You can't even back him up. You know, of course he don't stop, you know, and they want to change bits. They want to do all these different techniques. They want to buy a formula, or he's got ulcers, or he's got his back's out or something. Well, the fact of the matter
he needs a supplement.
When you take the slack out. Yeah. He needs a supplement. I mean, the fact of the matter is, when you lift the slack out of the reins, which is a feel, when that slack comes out, he doesn't even know what it is. And then when you pull a little harder, he pushes against you. And all you're wanting is the back feet to back up. So I say, just sit on him, focus on the back feet. I mean, that's all you do. And then when you get all that four backwards, left and right done, then we'll see how bad his face and head and neck are. Let's see how bad that is later. And I look at that in life. Just get to doing your purpose, you know, and doing what God put you here to do, and get to doing all that at 100% effort, and then see what else is there, all the theatrics that you need to take care of, all this thing you thought was problems, because a lot of those things kind of, you still have problems, but a lot of those things aren't there anymore to deal with. I think you just stay focused and you don't have to deal with all the other stuff.
Yeah.
And try to get around like-minded people. Like-minded people help a lot. A high tide raises all boats. And it's you got to be really careful of who you hang around. It's not because you're too good to hang around them. It's just because, you know, you want to be like-minded around like-minded people so that you can grow with them. Bounce ideas off one another.
No, 100%. Like, if you want to be a really good roper, find yourself in a roping pen where you're the worst one and see what happens. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you spend your time around people who are of high quality and you don't even have to say anything, you just watch. Shut up and watch. That goes for freaking pickleball, dude. Like, if you want to get good at ping pong, go play people who are good at ping pong and see what happens. Cause they're going to want you to get better. If you're going to hang around, they're going to want you to be better at the skill, whatever the skill may be. And it's the minutia of all of it is fabricated in your brain. Typically, most of it, some things actually matter, but a lot of it doesn't matter. And a lot of it, especially for men, is just chaos that the enemy creates to pull you off of the path, you know, and the better you get at honing your mind. I tell the kids, I have my nephew worked for me this summer, and then my son Wiley comes to work, and I tell him the only way out of the work is through the middle of it. That's it. So find what you need to do, and let's say it's 20 tie strings today. Floundering around, whining, woe is me, ain't going to get a damn one of them done. And the boss is not going to let you leave until you're done. So the only way out is through. And you can do it crying. That's fine. I've done a lot of things I didn't want to do crying. But it's not going to go away. It's not going to go away. It's going to be right there in front of you the whole time. And God's plan for you is the same way. Because, it, you know, Philippians 3:10 is our verse that we named the company after. And it says, for our determined purpose is to come to know the King. Step one, to know God. Step two, share in his sufferings. So if you change sufferings for whatever you're supposed to do in life, okay? So whether that's suffering for other people, whether that's serving other people, whether that's teaching people something, whatever the case may be, whether that's cutting grass, right? We're going to suffer with God in that purpose. And what that ends up doing over the course of your life is it transforms you into his likeness. It makes you like Christ. So know God, suffer for him, and become like Christ. And that's what we're supposed to do. And the way in which you do that is that's what God's plan is. You know, I'm not going to say it's not usually. I'm going to say almost all the time, it's not what you want to do. It's going to look like some sacrifice. It's going to look like some long days. It's going to look like some things that are just difficult to accomplish. And that's because it's not your plan, but you have to figure out how to follow a feel. As a believer, it's no different than that horse underneath you. You offer the feel to the calf, you offer the feel to where you want to go, and a good horse follows the feel. And so our goal is to be a good horse and go, okay, Lord, I don't really want to go down there. I don't want it. I don't want to do that. But because you're you, because you are good, here we go. We're going to go down there.
And it makes us uncomfortable. And if you think about, most of our motivation for most things is based out of comfort. And the old adage is comfort brings misery. And I'm a firm believer in that. And those things that you're saying that, you know, God, you know, sometimes he has us do things and they cause us to be, get out of our comfort zone. But there's no growth in comfort. There's none.
No.
You know, whether you're always roping or hanging around people that are lesser than you, as far as not as good, that don't rise you up, you know? And I think you have to practice being uncomfortable and be okay with it. And the other thing you got to do is take criticism. You know, I heard on one of your other podcasts the other day talking about the people commenting on different things, you know, on videos. And I get the same thing. I mean, for goodness sakes, I mean, I post how to bridle a horse the other day and I had a rusty ring snaffle, because most ring snaffles, they'll have some rust on them a little bit. And they were screaming that horse needs a tetanus shot. And I'm like, are you serious? but that's okay. You have to be okay. You know, I have people going to bat for me and saying, did you read what they put on there? And it's okay. It's fine.
Yeah.
They're ignorant, but you got to remember that everybody was ignorant and we are ignorant of different things. That's not our profession and it's fine. It's fine. Mm-hmm. And they have a voice too. They can get on there and be a keyboard warrior. It's fine. And you have to have an open mind and a thick skin. You got to have both of them. And that's difficult.
The freaking trolls, dude. Ugh. The freaking trolls. The internet trolls just waiting under the bridge.
They get on my Instagram. I post a lot of videos on Instagram, and they get on there, and they'll comment. But the majority of the people really support you, and it's a really good thing. And you have to keep that in mind, or else you'll get depressed, and you'll quit making content.
Mm-hmm. That's a fact. I can tell you, I tell people all the time, there's one person on earth at this point in my life that can hurt my feelings, and she sleeps in my bed with me every night. Everybody else can freaking kick rocks, buddy. I don't give a damn what y'all think. Yeah. And that mentality's led to this podcast, because I get on here and say some wild stuff, dude. I'll be talking about some craziness. But I don't know, man. It's very funny to me, like, the cowboy world. I have such a love-hate relationship with the Western culture and the cowboy world, because I'm a very, I just don't follow the norms. I like a t-shirt, dude. I like athletic shorts. Mm-hmm. It's hot here, you know? And my belief is none of those things make you a cowboy. They don't. And I know guys who have never touched a horse who are more cowboy than guys who call themselves cowboys, who are just, they can suffer. Like, a cowboy to me is a guy who can freaking suffer better than anyone on earth. Like, the job that we are required to do out there is so freaking challenging, and people have no clue how truly difficult the job is. And the videos make them look, that it makes the job glamorous. And there's a Gail Steger song where he's talking about the romance is gone. And there's these fleeting moments of, like, pure joy in your day or your month or whatever. And that's very true. But the majority of it is just really hard and really uncomfortable. And a large part of my first several episodes with guests, I would ask the questions like, you know, why do you think a cowboy enjoys suffering so much? Because that's the heart behind the podcast, is like, as men, as husbands, as fathers, as cowboys, as freaking whatever you do for a living, you're going to suffer. You're going to be asked to suffer by someone else, or by the king, or by your children, or by your wife. And how do we suffer well? And there's very few people on earth that I've met that suffer as well as cowboys do. Not only do they do it well, but they freaking like it. Like, the worse it is, they freaking love it. They want to tell the story. They want to take you with them to suffer. They just, like, it's a conundrum to me, you know?
Yeah, and they're very passionate about it. And it's a different culture, and it's very different. And then within those cultures, you have subcultures, I believe. But I enjoy being around them. I think they're friendly and nice, and I enjoy being around like-minded people. I just got back from Nevada. When we first scheduled this, I had to go to Nevada also, and I went out there and stayed a week at one of my mentors, and there's a gathering of like-minded people there, and it's just so nice to be around those people that are sharing common interest, and you allow you to grow. And it's just a refreshing, it's very refreshing, because as cowboys also, a lot of cowboys work alone a lot of the time. And so that's another challenge with it. And like, and it's very refreshing, and it's kind of like it's an educational vacation, but it's almost like a vacation just to go be around others that are like-minded, that think the way you do, and at least gear that way.
Well, there's a lot to be learned from it. And the guys like him, I don't know if we can say his name or not, but guys like him, and I've never met him. I don't know him from Adam. But that guy is elite. Like, his level of discipline, his level of ability. It's like when talent meets work ethic and you got both, like, just wildly talented and just the hardest working sun buck on earth. And then that's the product you end up with. And watching his stuff, and I don't know anything about show horses, nothing.
Yeah.
But watching that guy, you're like, holy smokes, dude, that guy's a freak. I mean, he is just that. And it's work ethic. I know it's not just talent. I know it's not, because you don't get that product without just being an absolute animal of your craft, you know, a savage in your realm.
Right. And come from very humble beginnings. You know, it's not like they were born into this some elite thing, you know, and that's what I respect that much more. And not that people can be born into it and still be good. That's fine. I have no problem with that. But when people come from outside of it, it's a lot. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. I respect that a lot. You know,
me too, dude. Well, and that's kind of like I didn't grow up doing this. You know, I didn't pick up a rope till I was 25 years old, you know, and I thank God every day for my ability to manipulate a rope. And I'm like, I don't know why you gave me this, but here we are. Like, I don't know why I can do what I do with this thing. And it's been a really interesting, and it might be for this podcast, just to have the opportunity or the respect of people that do not know me, just because of what I can do with a rope, to be able to sit down and tell them Jesus is the King.
Yes.
You know, like, maybe that's what it is. Who knows? And I tell people all the time, like, nobody steps out of the womb being able to do what you want to do with a rope. Like, this is hours and hours and hours of failing and practice, and on an unthankful thing. It's not like I throw a baseball 99 miles an hour, or I can, you know, catch the biggest fish of everybody else. It's like, nobody really cares other than the people that watch our videos that I can do that. Like, my own family, dude, like the people I live around in Alabama, they don't give a damn that I can rope good. They don't care. They have no need for it. No use. I mean, there's literally a giant banner of me in Italy roping a cow, and my family's like, yeah, you're good at roping, whatever, you know? And, but there's this subsect of this, the like, that I have influence just because God gave me that talent, to where I can sit down and have a conversation with somebody and they would actually listen to what I have to say just because I can throw a rope a long way, which is crazy to me. But growing up in it is not necessary. It is not. And everybody talks about gatekeeping. Okay, whatever, dude. You got to find a niche. You got to find the people who are willing, because like, I literally have devoted my life for the last 10 years to building 310 EDU. Like, go there. You can learn all of it. Like, a lot of it, as far as that, as I'm concerned. And not only can you learn a lot of it there, you can watch it a million times. And that's how I got good at roping. I mean, watching myself miss a million times. So there's pockets of people who want to mentor and want to teach and all the things. You just have to find it, man. There's crappy people in every industry. But oddly enough, all the places I go, are typically like super cool people. Typically, there's been a few where I'm like, yeah, this is kind of that. They got that that nose up feeling. You know what I mean? They're looking at you like you don't belong here, especially because I'm from Alabama. You know, and like I'm not in a hub for cowboys. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that is something I feel like you guys, I mean, I don't know, but you can tell me, but you guys have kind of broke into this ranch open deal and you aren't the norm. You guys are from Alabama, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not the norm. Yeah.
Mm-mm. No, not at all. We're like a hybrid, dude. Like, because we use, like, Dad learned a lot of the loops from, like, the Martin Black videos and the Buck Brannum videos and stuff, and he used them Dr. Nearlands. And I'll be honest with you, I have not seen or worked on a ranch in all of my journeys over the last half a decade that was even close to the amount of work that the ranch I started on in Alabama was, because it never stops. The grass never quits growing. The cattle never stop coming. Like, daylight to dark every single day of the year except Thanksgiving and Christmas, and you're pissed that you got to take off for those days because the work is so much more the next day. It's just how it is down here, and I would say that that was really, like, I had natural ability, and then God put me in some soil to where it was like, okay, for the next 3 years, I'm going to sharpen this tool to the degree. And I didn't even start with the fancy stuff, fancy shots, until after I quit there, because you didn't use them. But I had such a good foundation of manipulating a rope as far as Dr. Nearlands go. And then when we went to moving around, like, you get into buckaroo culture, the vaqueros, or the California guys or whatever. And the funny joke around here is, you know, in Texas, kind of their motto is hurry up every chance you get. And then the buckaroos motto is there's always tomorrow. And so when I'm roping, my mantra is there's always tomorrow. But when I'm in my daily life, I'm a Texan. I'm a hurry up every chance you get. And so it's kind of this parallel to where we cater to both. Like, I tie horn knots and 30-foot ropes for punchers. And I also sell 70-foot ropes to vaqueros that rope that way. And so most of these other places, like, they only cater to their niche. They only cater to their people, right? So, like, Buckaroo Business, who do you think buys their crap from Buckaroo Business? Buckaroos, right? So we market. Hey, can you stop that? It's wildly loud. We market to all of them. So I've done clinics in Texas. I've done clinics in Idaho. I've done clinics in West Virginia. You know what I mean? Like, I don't care. If you want to rope stuff, I want to rope it with you. And if you tie off, I hope you're handy with it. But I don't care how you rope. I don't care what you put on your horse's face. I don't care what kind of saddle you ride. Man, if you do this job for a living, you're freaking cool. Like, if you wake up every morning and you cowboy, in my opinion, no matter where it is, what kind of gear you use, or how long your rope is, you're a freaking badass, because it is hard regardless. And people make fun of me all the time. Like, my nickname for a number of years on Instagram was the Hillbilly Hip Roper. Roll Tide. Roll Tide, you know? But whatever, man. Like, I don't know. I think it's all really cool. Hang on just a second. Come here. Did I ask you to stop? Did you stop? Okay. What do we need to do about that? Are we gonna stop? Yeah? Are we gonna stop? Yes, sir. Nice. Go sit down. Sorry. It's very distracting. Yeah, dude, the Hillbilly Hip Roper. That was a tough nickname. I stayed pretty pissed about that one.
Yeah. But you put yourself out there, and that's where, when we put ourselves out there, we're going to get, we're going to get feedback like that. And that's what
blogs don't
understand. Yeah, trolled all the time. Yeah, all the time. And it's just part of it.
Well, see, my favorite, one of my favorite YouTube channels of all time is called the DOD King. This guy's a golfer. So a DOD in golf is a driver off the deck, meaning you hit your driver without a tee. Okay. No one does this. No one does this. But this guy hangs his hat on being able to do it well. And so his most popular YouTube series is called The War Against Weasels. And so anyone that talks smack to him on the internet, he gets in his car, drives to their home golf course, and plays them in golf for money. And if I am ever independently wealthy, do you understand me? I will have a half-top trailer, a freaking solid mount, and I will come to you, and we will rope. You know what I mean? It's like, let's go. And it's just... Yeah. That's kind of my mindset, and it would be the funniest videos on earth. You just pull up at a guy's house, yeah, like, okay, what do you want to do? Let's go. The hillbilly hip roper's here. You want to freaking get after it? Let's go. You got something to doctor? Come on, man. So it's funny to me because these people, they don't get out there. They just don't.
No, they don't put themselves out there, and that's where we like have horse shows. I mean, a lot of the horse show stuff, and I found it doesn't matter what you do in the horse show business, it all, some of it looks easy. But it is very hard when it's measured and judged. Mm-hmm. It's very hard. To each his own. It doesn't matter mm-hmm. what it is. I don't care if it's a rail class where they tell you to walk, trot, and lope and extend trot. It doesn't matter. You'd be surprised how many people said, well, that looks easy. I can do it. And I want people to think kind of like you do. I want to welcome everybody into it. And I think anybody can do it. But it's simple, but it's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's just like anything, you have to work at it. A trail class looks like, you lope in there, you open a gate, and you walk over a bridge, and, you know, you trot around some cones, and you open a mailbox. But you can break that down, and you'd be surprised how hard it is to do at a very high level. It's difficult. Mm-hmm. Just like going down the fence. And these guys I'm watching right now, you know, people going down the fence on this horse show. And, you know, that's hard. That is very hard.
Well, I get it because of the roping. Like, I can go doctor 20 yearlings in a day and not even think about it. But you stick me in that guapo pen in front of all those people, boy, we tightened up. Now I know Grease BB fitting in that thing. Like, I'm nervous. Yeah. Like, and I've roped thousands, tens of thousands of calves. But when it's on the line, you know what I mean? If one breaks back on me in a pen, well, we're freaking getting, we're going to turn them back, right? Totally different. Can I lope my horse in circles and offer a flying lead change? Sure. Sure, I can. Can I do it at the world's greatest horseman? No. No, I can't. Yeah. My horse would freaking run off. Yeah. He'd just run off. And I just, I don't even want to do that. I'm like, uh-uh, dude. I'll watch those things and I'm like, oh my gosh, dude, the pressure, like, pressure of those guys running and sitting them down and stopping. And y'all got to understand, I'm a working cowhand. So like if my horse cheats me or does something silly, like my reaction is typically not public approved. You know what I'm saying? Like we freaking get after it. You know what I mean? Like I'd be in there bending them around, making them spin circles, like freaking back up, dude. Like, what are you doing? You know, like, it's so terrible. And I teach people this stuff. That's what's crazy.
No. It's the same in my world. It's the same deal. You know, to each his own, and everybody has their own world, and it's hard in its own perspective, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, that roping in front of people sucks.
You know, you asked me a while ago about what I'd tell a 20-year-old me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is something that I'd want to tell anybody listening or anything. And it's not related to really just the stuff here, but something that I have found is I would tell the 20-year-old me, and I advise everybody to do this in the world, is to get a Bible, and I don't even care what kind of Bible, and to read that thing front to back on your own without anybody talking in your ear.
Mm-hmm.
And you read it and develop and draw your own conclusions the first time. Read the thing front to back. Without anybody telling you this is what it means, you read it front to back yourself first the first time, and then get with groups and study it thereafter. I think if I could go back to the 20-year-old me, that's something that I would have liked to have done earlier in life. You know, I think that would have benefited, and I think there could have been a lot of value and stuff come from that.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with that wholeheartedly. It that learning who Jesus actually was, not what the church says he is, changed my life completely. Yes. Because he is not candy, and the church acts like he is, and he ain't. He ain't. The God we serve is not.
And if you read that Bible all the way through, you know, I mean, I grew up in church, and as I know you did also. I think I've heard you talk about it on other podcasts, but I've reading it through. You're like, well, I've never heard of this in Sunday school. Mm-hmm. I've never heard anything about this, or I've never put it this way, or I didn't know this. And I think it's just very important for everybody to do that. I think there's a lot of a lot can be gained from that. And then get with groups and study it. I think you should study in groups and get other people to discuss it and like-minded people.
Yeah, a lot of it's going to be like, I mean, just straight over the old noggin there. Like dive into Leviticus, old son. That's a tough one to chew on there. But it's funny you say that because when my son was born, he was in the NICU for like 5 weeks. And so I would go up there every morning on my way to the apartment or the way to the cattle company. And I got there about 3:30 in the morning and I'd stay till about 5. And I was like, okay, I'm going to read them old Bible stories. Like, you know, and I didn't have any kids books or anything. I mean, he was my first and all the things. So I just took my Bible up there and just read them David and Goliath. And so you think of David and Goliath, you got King David and he's a kid, you know, 14 years old or whatever. And he kills Goliath with the slingshot and that's the end of it. You know, the little guy conquers the big guy because God helped him and yada, yada, yada. So I'm sitting here reading it. There's nurses everywhere. He's in his little NICU box and I got Bible verses taped all over it. And I'm reading them, David and Goliath. And we get that part of the story. He's picking the stones, you know, and he goes up there and freaking centers him in the forehead. And then you get past that part and the story continues. It doesn't stop right there. Goliath goes down. The Philistines are defeated. And David walks right over there, picks up Goliath's sword, chops his freaking head off, and then holds it up for his army. And I'm sitting in the NICU. The nurses were like, what in the hell are you reading that kid? It was so funny. I was like, dang, dude, they never even talked about this part. Like,
no.
Your king, your God is a freaking savage. There is nothing candy about the leader of our army. You know what I mean? Until I started learning these things, I didn't know, dude. I didn't know that's my lineage. Those are the men that I'm supposed to emulate. He freaking cut his head off, dude. You defeat the enemy at all costs, you know? Like, dadgummit, man. Yeah. It's read it. Freaking read it and then come on. Like, one of y'all listening, you read it and then you email me and come on the podcast and let's talk about it because it'll change your life.
Yeah, it will. Read the whole thing all the way through. Yeah, and I don't, like I said, I'm not going to argue what kind, you know, Living Bible or New Translation or whatever. I'm not going to get into that. That's a whole other rabbit hole. But read your Bible, you know. You know, that's kind of like to me arguing about what bit to use. Just get a ring snaffle. I don't care who made it, or get a halter. Put a halter on it. Just do something. You know,
just get up there. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. Just do something. I swear, man.
I swear, I've avoided the bit conversation like the plague on here. I'm like, anybody starts talking about it, I'm like, yeah, so anyway, when did you meet your wife? I just don't do it. Yeah. I'm just not gonna. I don't care. I don't care what you use. Yeah. Good horsemanship is good horsemanship. You could stick a freaking Mack truck in his mouth and it don't matter. Don't touch it. Yeah. You know, like it doesn't matter if you don't use it. I mean, what the heck? Oh my goodness, it's funny. My dad, dude, he is not the one. He is not the one to try to convince that the bridle is the way. He is not it. Yeah. So we, and we always come back to the conclusion of like, hey man, I get along with my horse. Okay. I'm good. He's good. We get the job done. It's all good. Yeah. You riding whatever you want to ride in. It's funny. 'Cause a lot of my friends are bridle horsemen. You know what I mean? Like,
yes,
all of them, like pretty much all of them are. And they all got something to say about my hackamore. You know, we do ride in a hack now. It's not just a halter. We have a hackamore.
Yeah. I've seen that. Yeah. I've seen it.
Yeah. We've upgraded.
Yeah.
Hey, when we started, man, we were broke cowboys. You know what I mean? Like affording a saddle was something special. To have a bunch of bits hanging around, like, what are you guys selling your souls to the devil to get these things? Those things are like $1,500 bucks a piece. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't. Them bits cost more than my freaking car, dude. Like, what are you serious? Come on, man. Did you find it in a thrift shop somewhere? But anyways, go ahead. No, nothing.
I get people, they'll laugh and they'll say, where's all your bits? I said, I just got like two or three. I really don't have a plethora. And I said, we start them in a rope halter. And I said, if they're my horse and not the public's horse, I said, I accidentally sometimes like ride them in a rope halter. Used to, I'd ride them way too long if it was my horse. I mean, I'd ride them several months in it because I'd be getting along with them great. Mm-hmm. And but I said, if it's going to the public, I will put a snaffle in their mouth just because the public's going to do it. And if the public's going to do it, I'd rather me be the one doing it than them for the first time.
No, 100%. We do that too. Yeah. We got a snaffle bit set up if they're, you know, if they're going to somebody else or whatever. And I mean, you have to. That's not fair. That is not fair.
Yep, it's not.
I got one horse that's like, he probably wouldn't tolerate it very much. You'd have to be real light, like real light in the snaffle, even a snaffle. But anyways, it's like talking about religion, dude. Freaking stay away from that. If you're Church of Christ and you think you're the only one going to heaven, okay, buddy. Like, I don't know. I don't know, but I'm not going to argue with you about it, you know? My goodness. Yeah. It's so funny. Jesus loves you. I promise you that. That's all I know is that I love you and Jesus loves you. Oh, my goodness.
As the people around here say, as they say down south in the far south, when you're a little ignorant, they just say, bless your heart.
Hey, facts. That's it. We're going to chalk it right up to that. And it's probably hanging at my mom's house somewhere. I swear. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Well, Jason, tell the people where they can find you, man, if they're in your area or online or how can they get in touch?
I'm in Cassville, Missouri. I've got an online website, jc-horsemanship.com. And then you can find us on Facebook and Instagram, just JC Horsemanship or Jason Cook, whichever you want. And then a YouTube channel, JC Horsemanship. You can pretty much reach us by just Googling this. You can find us on there. And sweet, I have a podcast too. I do have the podcast Changing Eyes podcast. It's on Spotify and all your other podcast carriers.
Okay, cool. I'll have to look that up. Hang on. Let me put that in my show notes. Yeah. Changing Eyes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Cool, man. I'll check that out. Well, Jason, man, I sure do appreciate you coming on. I hate we had a bunch of snaffling scheduling snafus, but that's kind of my life right now. It's wild out here. But yeah, man, thanks for coming. We appreciate you guys. As always, Dalton at 310EDU. If you need me, please reach out. My phone number is at 310EDU.com. We are right in the middle of doing our summer sale for the educational site. So all memberships are 50% off. Use code SUMMER50. Go check that out. As always, thanks for watching. I'll see you in the next video.
Thank you.